great news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast.
Yo, this episode of the Big Ball Broadcast may offend those who get more butthurt over sensitive issues.
Now here comes your host, Kirby, of the World Team.
Welcome to the Big Ball Broadcast for what I believe is episode 105. We are part of the Geek Media, so check that out. We are more than all the geeky news you could ever friggin' possibly use. Kyle's still away to con. Hates us, apparently, so filling in this week as your host, I am Otherworld Steve. I am a musician and a writer.
And I am Mark Swint, the temporary host on the East Coast, co-host. I am an amateur voice actor, artist, engineer for the show, and the guy who's constantly pulling his hair out over technical difficulties that this show is having.
Coming up on this y'all podcast, Spike TV to chase pirates with the U.S. Navy. QTV launches console IPTV platform. Stay tuned for the shocking console announcement. Spider-Man 4 possibly in the third dimension. And Amazon's now selling Xbox Live Arcade games. And of course, a big follow-up on the Pirate Bay trial that we talked about last podcast. Mark and I have quite a bit of banter on that. Mark, how are you doing? How was your night?
Well, I think that we pretty much had the exact same syntax of a day. You woke up, you feel really good, and then all of a sudden, somewhere near the middle and towards the end of your day, everything goes to absolute hell. Where I got hammered at work, I couldn't get any show notes together, I couldn't write any witty anything for the show, and then my bank account, yay, perfect. And then my bank account reflected zero, which forced me to run out and make me late for the show. So, unfortunately, yeah, I'm, what's that word? Pissed! How about you, Steve?
My day started great. I played hooky from work, got together with Perimeter of the Void. We actually recorded a brand new song, brand new single, that hopefully we should be able to debut in a couple weeks. I've got a little tweaking left to do on it. But we're gearing up for the Magnum Farce movie soundtrack, which we're pretty jazzed about. So yeah, recording wrapped, and my night just went down the shitter from there. I had to go into work and do stuff that people didn't do, and I thought being management got me out of those responsibilities, but apparently not. But you know what? We're here now, and I don't know about you, but I'm pretty damn happy that we're rolling live again, another episode.
Yes, with absolutely no technical difficulties to speak of, other than the fact that we tried to not use Ustream, but use StickCam once more to let more people know, because it's more whorish, like Kyle. But unfortunately, it still hates me. So here we are on Ustream, but I'm happy, because we're live.
We are live. Episode 105 and still alive. Pretty impressive for a podcast. Mark, let's dive right on in here. So what's going on with the Pirate Bay verdict after what we talked about last week?
Okay, this has been reported around the internets on a number of sites, but I managed to pull it from g4tv.com because it's one of the places that I frequent. Judge Thomas Nordstrom, who presided over the recent trial that convicted the file-sharing site The Pirate Bay of breaking copyright law and sending four men to a year in Swedish prison, has admitted that he is a member of two anti-piracy organizations, causing the defense attorney to move the case for a mistrial. Peter Alflin, the lawyer in question, says that Nordstrom's involvement in the organizations, with the organizations, the Swedish Association for Copyright and Swedish Association for Protection of Industrial Property, and that the original verdict should be thrown out. For this part, Nordstrom denies the bias. The Pirate Bay had already planned to appeal the decision, but now they have more ammunition for that retrial. This is amazing. This is, to me, this is the biggest, most awesome news in terms of the rights of the internet ever, where it's like, well, you're all biased. Just face it. If you're complaining, if you're working in any kind of industry where your internet, where not your internet, but where your IPs are readily available on the internet, then you're going to be biased. So of course you're going to want to throw us in jail because we just cheated you out of a brand new private jet, or we just cheated you out of a car. This is great. This is amazing to me.
Oh, it's equally amazing to me as well. I don't know if it'll necessarily change the outcome of the trial, because, you know, this is going on in Sweden, and I think they're trying to set a precedent to show people file sharing is bad, and, you know, they get a lot of pressure from political organizations, primarily from the U.S., as far as, you know, our diplomatic relations with other countries. The U.S. kind of really pushed this issue, so even with a different judge, I don't know. It might get somebody else who doesn't have any party affiliations, but if you grease the palm just right, could be another conviction. Who knows? Could be even more jail time and higher fines in the end.
Well, I think that if we continue in this vein of just discrediting whoever it is that drops the gavel calling it guilty, the internet will win. If, you know, the next judge that drops the gavel and says they're guilty, if they, like, find out her that person's daughter has, you know, a LimeWire account and a 500 gig hard drive that's packed to the rafters, that would be awesome.
It'll be interesting. You know, as we talked about, there were four people that were put on trial. All four were convicted. All four are to serve a one-year sentence, I'm assuming, much like the U.S., you know, maybe 3 or 4 months out with good behavior. And they're responsible for, I believe it's like a $3.19 million fine, but they get to pay that collectively. It's not on each individual.
It actually seems like the numbers are slightly off, because I know that in the U.S., whenever they move for trial and whenever they try to drop the gavel on, you know, some 14-year-old kid who really, really liked Hanson, it's always like $200,000 in infringement or something like that. And the number is always ridiculously small in terms, like proportionate to the number of songs that they downloaded. So it's like, oh, well, you downloaded 14 songs. That means you owe us a couple million bucks. But I guess in Sweden, they're just like, eh, it's $200,000 is too much. I mean, it's $200,000 American. So, that's right. American money's worthless now. Woo.
You know, it's funny because as an artist with Perimeter of the Void, I could never see prosecuting somebody for downloading my stuff illegally. Especially now, the MPAA and the RIAA, well, the RIAA, anyway, wants $150,000 per downloaded file. So if you download an album that has, you know, say 10 tracks, you're talking $1.5 million. That is absolutely ridiculous. I could never see how the courts can justify that type of expense. You can't say that because I downloaded an album that I denied the artist or the record label $1.5 million in sales. If you took me to court and said, hey, you know, $12.99 for downloading the album and not paying for it, fine, I could go for that. I understand that doesn't slap you hard enough, not enough of a precedent to keep you from repeating that offense, but it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that the best way in order for anyone to counteract this is for just someone so brazen, so ballsy to get on the stand and say, like, all right, I owe a couple $1 million because I downloaded an entire album. Okay, well, I was downloading albums within the past, we'll say, a span of a decade, which means that each one of those albums only had 10 songs on it. So how about this? You subtract how many songs have been cheated out of when CDs turned from 16, 17, 20 songs all the way down to 10. So however many songs I don't get and yet I'm still paying full price for CDs, just subtract that and then give me the new number.
Well, and that's why, you know, I don't mean to drop this, but it's what we talked about last week on the podcast, or 2 weeks ago actually, Perimeter of the Void, free for download. Go to ebrecords.com, check out the shop page, you can download it for free because there's just no point in fighting the piracy right now. So many people online have that feeling of entitlement for music and movies that are made available, so we decided, much like Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, if you can't beat them, join them, and hopefully things will develop from there with people listening to the music. But again, I couldn't imagine prosecuting people for downloading something.
Well, how much of a douche do you look like when you want to call someone to court and then they turn out to be a 14-year-old girl who gets a $10 allowance every other week for mowing the lawn? Like, no, we're still gonna sue her for $500,000. Because she stole from us. I am not driving a Maserati because of that 14-year-old girl right there who downloaded my album once.
I mean, again, I understand why they're doing it. You need to set some kind of legal precedence to say what you're doing is illegal. What you're doing is wrong. And with the sentiment, I agree with it 100%. I don't think it's your right or your entitlement to take something that's keeping money from the artist. At this point, I really don't care about the labels. But if you're taking some from the artist, I think, deserve the compensation. That's their bread and butter. Let's put it into perspective with Kyle Hebert. You know, Kyle is a voice actor, and he doesn't have any other employment other than his voice acting. So if people started going crazy, pirating all the anime and different things that he's in the studios, not making the money, now Kyle's not getting calls anymore, so Kyle's not working. You literally do hurt the little people. And when you look at a film, films in general, and I know this came up during the Wolverine leak, people everywhere from the caterers to the limo drivers to the grips on the set, everybody's dependent on this film making money for them to get a paycheck. So you're literally taking money out of people's mouths. I understand that, but the methodology here, the approach to the situation, just seems asinine. The record labels and the movie studios are dealing with an archaic business model. You know, the internet is here. The internet's not going anywhere. They should have adapted 4 or 5 years ago to streaming downloads and pay for plays and whatnot, but they didn't. So now they're trying to scramble and play catch up. So I wonder how long it's going to take before they stop prosecuting these types of quote unquote crimes.
Well, short of locking down the internet, which the more people pirate, the more these, like, it's just a strange loop. The more people pirate, the more trials are going to pop up. The more those trials are going to get either thrown out or they're just going to lose. And that's just going to encourage people to make a bigger statement through piracy, where it's just like, well, you just took down the Pirate Bay, but now here's Pirate Earth. And it'll get bigger, and the statements, like, no matter how many shots you fire into the dark on this, where it's like, all right, and pow, there goes the Pirate Bay. Pow, there goes LimeWire. They will come up with something bigger, better, and far more detrimental to the industry that is trying to supposedly protect itself and its property and its interests. And it's getting so ridiculous with these trials. I mean, I'm totally behind Trent Reznor, because the fact is that he's all for the new business model, to the point where he freaked out at his label over the fact that when Year Zero came out in Australia, it was $20 more in Australia than it was here in the States. And he asked them why, and they said, well, you have a big fan base in Australia. I have a big fan base here. What's your point? Well, it's the paper. The paper changes color when you put it in the CD player. And he looked up how much the paper cost. It cost 17 cents a CD, to which after that point, he was just like, you know what? Screw it. I was going to put out an entirely new Halo for this, and I was going to have new remix albums, like a couple of them. Forget it, because they're just going to rape each and every person who likes my music just so that way they can make up these lost sales from the internet. No, I'm not doing this anymore.
Reznor's funny, and again, I want to direct everybody over to dig.com, where they did their little Q&A with Trent Reznor. Reznor said, I realized I was screwed when I sat down and signed my first record deal when they said we were going to get 80 cents per disc sold. But that was after we paid them back for the recording studio, after we paid them back for the duplication of the CD and the shipping, and after we paid them back for all tour expenses. So realistically, for a band getting signed to a major label, it could be a year to 2 years before they start seeing any revenue, and it's all per diem, and it's pretty scary. And Reznor, you know, it was a real risky move. It was pretty ballsy to say, we're going to operate without a label, and we're going to fly with this regardless. And I certainly tip my hat to him, and he has been a very big influence for the way I approach music now. You know, if you want free music, go to the artists who are providing free music. Go download Perimeter of the Void, go download Nine Inch Nails, go download who the heck was the other band? Radiohead, when they did their release for free. Well, it was whatever you want to pay. Most people said, well, I don't want to pay anything. So that's what I say. Go download that music. Don't go to places like the Pirate Bay and download other people's music who are relying on that check. I know it sounds rather preachy, but if you think about it, it's really the truth.
One of the problems, and one of the things that almost makes me a proponent of pirating, is the fact that CDs go out of print, and they go out of print fast. It's ridiculous. You can seriously still find on the shelves Pretty Hate Machine. You can still find The Downward Spiral. But try and find The Fragile. Try and find Further Down the Spiral. Try and find, you know, anything between the main albums that makes Trent Reznor Trent Reznor. And you will be standing in front of your FYE guy or sitting in front of your computer on Amazon trying to find these rare CDs, to which I'm trying to figure out, like, well, why is this CD so rare? Why should it be rare? It's just a remix thing, and it's still good. It's still content that I want. Like, I own a bunch of DJ Shadow CDs, and I had to go out of my way to try and find all the ones that were in between the Introducing album, the Private Press, Preemptive Strike. I had to go and find the High Noon album. And, you know, in the 90s, when that was kind of cool to hunt down the album of your favorite artist, like, of course, I think it was The Fragile that came in a double disc case, but it only had one disc in it, and the only way you could find the other disc was to import the Japanese version of the Fragile. And that was cool then, but now with the price of CDs, and even with the internet making everything at your fingertips, it's still annoying, because you still have to hunt it down. You still have to make sure that it's not out of print. You have to make sure that if it's not out of print, that whoever it is that's selling it to you didn't jack up the price because of the fact that it's still rare because it's limited print. So having torrents is an amazing thing, because when I started listening to Curve, a British industrial band, I looked at their discography on Wiki and it said something like 14, 15 CDs. And I said, I can't find that many CDs. And I worked at FYE at the time, and I checked our special order thing because I figured, well, I work for an FYE, so I'll just special order it, do it the legit way. And half of them were out of print and out of stock, and the rest of them that were out of print and in stock cost 2 to 3 times more than what it was for the MSRP. So I downloaded it on Torrent, and I told myself that if Curve brings out another CD, I'll gladly buy it. I will be first in line to buy it. But then again, torrents also kind of make things a little bit easier in terms of like, well, this band hasn't put out an album in a while and I really don't want to pay for a bad album. Like, I'm fairly certain that a lot of people thought that about Saint Anger. Like, damn, why did I buy this? Like, this is not a Metallica album at all.
People bought Saint Anger. I'm sorry.
yeah, they did. It's weird, isn't it? They bought that not Metallica album. But it's the same thing goes for Linkin Park. Like, one of my friends who's a big freaking pirate, he actually burned me a copy of the new Linkin Park CD. And he told me, this is the second copy of the CD that I've burned, and it is the last copy of the CD I've burned, because I burned it based on the idea that I was going to buy it. Never mind. Because I burned it, I put it in my CD player in my car, and 3 songs in, out the window. So torrenting is good for that. If a band doesn't readily make their music available on their website, which nowadays they do. But these are the things that kind of make me a proponent. But at the same time, I understand that pirating is going to cheat them out of money. But I am one of the few that actually decides, well, I'm going to pirate it until I buy it. I just want to know what it sounds like from cover to cover.
Yeah, you know, I admit that has been my worst case scenario. I've gone into stores and tried to special order some stuff I grew up with that's relatively obscure. And it's just out of print. Nobody has it available anymore. And some of these bands just are defunct. They don't even have websites anymore. So I've gone ahead and done that, but not with any of the major label dudes. Mostly fear of reprisal. I know a lot of people forget about that. There's that aspect where they'll grab your IP and they're going to prosecute you. And for me, that's enough to stay on the straight and narrow.
Which, if anyone wants to know how it is they track those, they're not necessarily always tracking you by your IP. They're tracking by... there's a bit of static. They actually insert white noise, and they purposely put files on torrent sites. And when they grab your IP, they need proof that you didn't buy it, because obviously if you downloaded it, it's a perfect copy of whatever it is that gets burned from a CD, from Winamp, from Windows Media Player, or from Nero. So that particular version of the MP3 has white noise in the first 2 seconds. And if that white noise is in when they check your hard drive for those files, then they know that you stole that track.
That's very interesting. I never really knew exactly how they did that. Alrighty, let's talk about Amazon. Amazon.com, everybody's favorite alternative to eBay. Well, apparently they're now selling Xbox Live Arcade games. Amazon might still make most of its money by shipping physical items to your door, but it's clear that the retail giant knows the future of media is digital. Not only is it pushing Kindle and services like Amazon Video On Demand, is expanding its downloadable video game catalog to include Xbox Live Arcade games. The process seems a little clunky at the moment. You buy a code from Amazon that you have to enter into your Xbox, and it's not exactly easy to compare prices, since Amazon charges you real money instead of Xbox Live points. But we're not going to complain too much about anything that increases gamer choice. The service is now live. What do you say, Mark, yet for a little shopping?
No, I'm not, because I have an Xbox. My Xbox is 9 feet away from this machine that I am recording from right now. Why would I do that? Maybe if I'm at work and I get a wild hair up the bum and it's like, you know what, I feel like playing Sonic 2. I'm going to buy that on Amazon really quick. And then when I get home, I can get on my Xbox to put a code in, because it's not going to automatically download unless I put this code in. And see? No. And this is the evil of microtransactions. We were talking about them for like half an hour last week. And this is that dark side I was talking about, where they're just going to microtransaction everything. Would you do it?
Well, you know, what makes it sketchy is Microsoft deals with the Microsoft point system. Amazon's dealing with cash, and you kind of need a conversion chart to figure out what's the conversion between the points amount and the cash amount. Reading the chat, getting distracted. But Amazon has a reputation of being a better deal. Amazon sells live gold subscriptions, both monthly and for the year, and it's cheaper than getting it through Microsoft. So I think if you went ahead and looked at a conversion, it might be cheaper to deal with Amazon than Microsoft. I can't confirm that. Maybe at some time during the podcast, I can go ahead and check that out. But if it's a better deal, I've got nothing wrong with finding a better deal.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a better deal, it can't be denied. But at the same time, Microsoft is constantly running their own deals, especially with original Xbox games in the library, where I think they busted down Psychonauts from 1,200 points to, I think it was 800 points, which that in itself was good enough for me. And if Amazon sells it for any less than that, like, that's one of those quality games that I'm like, no, I want Tim Schafer to have my money. In fact, let me give him more if it gets Brutal Legend out any faster. In the general sense, I mean, yeah, Amazon's going to try and hand out deals left and right, but I can guarantee you that this system is not foolproof. It's probably not even tested as extensively as it could be or should be. So there's probably going to be a lot of complaints like, well, it's not accepting the code. What happened? Or it's going to be like, what does it mean that this code that I just got 30 seconds ago has already been used? You know, it's heir to a lot of problems, and it's because of the fact that it's not a direct purchase. It's an indirect purchase. It's from your computer to your Xbox, and that is just too large a gap for me personally.
Even if there's a price difference, even if you can save, say, 20-25%?
Yeah. And it's because of the fact that I always feel like I get what I pay for. And sometimes I'm willing to pay a little bit more just so that way I'll pay a premium for a good service. Again, I've been paying for Xbox Live since the day it came out, while everyone around me was laughing, going, well, what would you pay for that? Steam's free. And in the fact that I am used to paying a premium, I'll continue to pay the Microsoft premium. I know that they put games on sale all the time, and I don't trust Amazon. I mean, Amazon's wrapped as tight as a drum, granted. I have never had a problem ordering from Amazon a day in my life. And maybe it's a bias because of the fact that my computer is only 9 feet away from my Xbox and my television. But I just don't trust it. I really, really don't trust the idea that I'm going to pay money to Amazon for them to give me a code that will supposedly be accepted by my Xbox. There is just something completely wrong and shady about it.
I don't know. I find it a bit weird because if you have a 360, then you're probably already familiar with the interface, and you, like you said, you have the ability to download games right then and there.
If Amazon could streamline the service to the point where I pay for it on Amazon, and then when I turn my Xbox on and it signs in my account, it says, you have one pending download, do you accept? And then you click yes, and then that's it, because the game is already paid for. That's an entirely different story, because then I could just buy games while I'm at work, just like, and I would go nuts. I'd be like, screw it, give me Sonic 2 and Smash TV and just a bunch of other stuff. And then when I get home, I'll just turn my Xbox on, walk away, and eat dinner, come back, they're all done. But the separation is just too much for me.
Yeah, it's certainly convenient, and the convenience is kind of built in, so kind of run with that.
So, Spider-Man 4 in 3 dimensions? Forbes talked to Sony Picture Entertainment's co-chairman Amy Pascal and Michael Lenton and asked whether or not they were considering doing Spider-Man 4 in 3D. Pascal answered, could be, while Linton added, people are paying a premium to see movies in 3D, and that's a very big deal. It's never been done before that someone says you have to pay more to see Spider-Man than a romantic comedy. 2D or 3D, we'll be seeing Sam Raimi's fourth installment on May 6, 2011, hopefully with less suck.
Less suck is a good thing.
Yeah, I want less suck, less Topher Grace, less Kirsten Dunst, and less Tobey Maguire. Please, for the love of God.
You know, it's interesting because as I drone on and on and on about digital delivery, having Blu-ray, having HDTVs, basically technology has given me every reason not to step foot in a movie theater anytime soon. So we're seeing this big push with the 3D movies. My only concern is it's going to turn very genreized, like in the 50s with the B movies, where that was the hook, because you otherwise wouldn't go into the theater to see such a crappy movie. If they're going to do it tastefully, sure, I'm all for it. That might be enough to get me out of the house to go to the theater and drop $900 on a ticket and $47,000 for a bag of popcorn. But if it's going to be done as a hook and it's not going to have anything to do with playing out the story or audience involvement, I really have no interest. I don't need another gimmick from Hollywood.
Yeah, Spider-Man 4 being in 3D is just stupid. And someone in the chat actually said, reboot the movie. And for a while, that was the idea. Because after Sam Jackson was Nick Fury in Iron Man, it was this really big billboard of, we're operating in the Ultimate Marvel Universe, which is the comics that we needed to reboot the entire Marvel continuity, because we just got bored and realized that we don't write as well as DC. So to have the Black Nick Fury and not David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury, one, is a good thing. Two, it also raised a lot of questions, which is, well, are they going to bother to reboot Spider-Man? And I was a proponent. I'm still a proponent of, yes, reboot Spider-Man. I don't need Tobey Maguire. Tobey Maguire is stiff. He is stiff as a freaking 2x4 in the North Pole. Give me a new Venom, because I understand why it is that Sam Raimi didn't want to do Venom. He thinks that Venom's two-dimensional and flat and blah, blah, blah as a villain, because he's not as interesting as the rest of Spider-Man's Rose Gallery. But the thing is, Spider-Man has one of the worst Rose Gallery in comics next to Wonder Woman, so that really couldn't be helped. And the fact is that Venom's entire origin story would have taken the span of three movies or four movies, with the Secret Wars and the alien costume and all of that stuff. So I would love to have a Spider-Man reboot, but instead I'm still stuck with Sam Raimi not doing Evil Dead 4, but instead doing Spider-Man 4, and now I get to deal with it in 3D because James Cameron really needs to get asses in seats for that new camera of his. I just don't want it, because that is what Cameron's doing now. He is pandering to every filmmaker on the face of the earth. Like, look, I've got a new camera. I'm James Cameron. I blew up a gas station in Terminator 2. Help me.
I was praying for a reboot. I was praying, and here comes the hate mail. I was praying Raimi was going to get booted off the project and they'd bring in a new director and just start from scratch. It worked really, really well for the Batman franchise. I see Sam Raimi handling Spider-Man. Yeah, I know a lot of it's due to the pressure put by Sony Pictures, but I see him handling the Spider-Man franchise kind of the way Tim Burton did to a certain extent. Not to that extreme, but, you know, my biggest complaint about Spider-Man 3 was it was oversaturated with the two villains. Too much Topher Grace, not enough Venom. Venom certainly wasn't the character he should have been. I really hate how, you know, you can kill off all these characters from a certain comic book universe, and there's no real repercussion. If Spider-Man's a franchise that's going to be going on for a while, why are you killing off so many people? It's pretty ridiculous. You just can't do it for the sake of bringing in new characters. You can introduce new characters, not kill off all the villains. I just read earlier this week that, you know, Sam Raimi's having a sit-down with Kirsten Dunst and talking about having her come back in the franchise and resume her role as Mary Jane, and in his eyes, hopefully not in limited capacity. I think Sony would like to see her role diminished quite a bit, focus on Peter Parker, focus on some of the villains. I would really love to see them just retool that franchise. I understand Raimi, you know, he's got some talent, and they are bringing in a lot of money from the Spider-Man films. My mantra, as I always say it, is if you want people to stop making crappy films, stop supporting them. But as long as you do, they're going to keep making them, and I'm going to talk smack about them. The franchise has already proven it's going to make money regardless.
Yeah, I mean, so long as they can keep making them, obviously, they're going to keep churning them out. They'll never kick Raimi off the ticket until he gets bored. And he's like, all right, you know what? I'm taking me and my Spidey camera and Bruce, and we're going to throw Bruce off a building with a chainsaw attached to his arm. Bye. I again, would love to see the reboot, but Raimi, of course, thinks that his vision of Spider-Man, being a Spider-Man fan, is the high echelon of Spidey fandom movies. But the problem is the fact that he does just treat every villain like he's expendable. Kill the Green Goblin? Go ahead. Kill the Sandman? Sorta. Go ahead. Kill Doc Ock? Yeah, whatever. Kill Venom? Yeah, especially kill him. While on the flip side of the coin is The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, where it's like, is Ra's al Ghul dead? No. Maybe. he could come back. Is Harvey dead? Definitely not. Because, of course, in comic books, nobody, no death. Is the Joker dead? No. We could totally reuse him, despite the fact that the actor's gone. So, whoever it is, like, all the people that write for DC movies just know what they're doing, while everybody that Marvel gets is just these action directors and writers. And that's what Marvel Comics is. It's pick up and read comics all the time. You don't really have to have read 50 comics back to understand what's going on in the comic that's directly in front of you. While DC, I mean, go ahead, try and pick up an issue of 52 and figure out what's going on without reading the first volume, and you are lost forever.
Well, you know, that's the bigger issue when you're talking about Hollywood doing these adaptations, is they're making movies for the casual moviegoer. They're not making these movies for people who grew up with, love, and appreciate the comic books. I've talked about this before. Marvel released some staggering numbers a couple years ago where they said that their comic sales only account for 10% of their annual income. That means that 90% of their annual income comes from the casual moviegoers and people who buy the associated merchandise. They're not relying on the diehard fans to make these movies successful. They're hoping to catch you with these quick-cut commercials, all, ooh, shiny, ooh, and people flock out to the theaters and see them, the good summertime popcorn flicks and the big Hollywood holiday blockbusters. So they're certainly not catering to the serious, you know, comic geeks. And unfortunately, Watchmen's a real good example of that. You have a film that's fairly, you know, dedicated to the original graphic novel, and it performed relatively lackluster in the theaters compared to the big franchises like Batman and Spider-Man.
And that's just the way that it goes for every truly brilliant comic book property that gets turned into a movie. It always does. It always will underperform compared to Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, despite the fact that Superman Returns just was a really, really bad idea. Because I was at Watchmen opening night, and of course, every theater was packed. And me and my friend, we bought our tickets for IMAX because we had no other choice. All the regular theaters were sold out. We bought them weeks in advance. And then I read the returns, and it's like, what do you mean it underperformed? This movie was sold out all weekend. But then you realize, like, oh, well, it isn't Spider-Man. It isn't Batman. It doesn't resonate with every man, woman, and child. It's like, oh, that's what I grew up with. And it's because of the fact that there are comic book movies for everyone, and then there's obviously comic book movies for comic book fans. The comic book fans watch comic book movies for everyone, and they just go, this is awful. Like, that's what we're doing right now as comic book fans. We were saying, Spider-Man 3 is awful. It's terrible. Tobey Maguire should be thrown off a building, and let's see if he can web-sling it all. But everyone else around us is just like, well, except in the case of Spider-Man 3, because that just sucked across the board no matter who you are. Like, that movie was brilliant. It was awesome. And this happened and that happened. And it was fireworks for me. And I lost my comic book virginity to this movie. And it's like, no, you didn't. Read The Watchmen. Read V for Vendetta. You know, read anything that's not on the front shelf of your local comic book store. And tell me that movie is still amazing. Even, like, crap, read the source material of what that movie was supposed to be and tell me that movie was still amazing, you know?
Well, that's what's kind of sad about anybody coming into comic books or revisiting comic books after a long hiatus. Like myself, you believe that what you see theatrically truly represents that character, and that's not the case. And what really epitomized that, even though it wasn't comic-related, it was anime-related, the horrid performance of Dragon Ball Evolution in the theaters. So much so, by the second week, it dropped off the chart entirely. Akira Toriyama himself came out and said, you have to look at this from an entirely different perspective. You have to look at this as like an other world, no pun intended, viewing, you know, yeah, the characters have the same name, and that's about where the similarities stop. But people, especially this younger generation who haven't had any exposure to Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z, and they go to the theater and they see it, if they hated it, they're not going to pursue the manga or the animated series and find what we love about it. And if they loved it and they decided to check out the anime and the manga, they're going to say, what the hell is this? This isn't what I just saw for 90 minutes on the screen. So it could cause some market confusion.
Well, I know exactly what it is that got Dragon Ball Evolution in the top 10 at all, which is every Dragon Ball fan, or at least 3/4, maybe a half of Dragon Ball fans and anime fans in general that grew up on Dragon Ball. I know that a good majority of people are just like, I want to go to see it just to help see how bad it is. And that's what got them in the high, is the fact that, like, okay, well, we have a bunch of kids who kind of wear Goku t-shirts and buy the figures and don't really understand anything that's going on in Dragon Ball Z, although that kind of is across the board, because after a while, they're just like, wait, 20 episodes went by, but they just said that the planet's going to blow up in 5 minutes, which is what they said 20 episodes ago, except it was 10 minutes then. That's weird. So that's what got them in the top 10. Just so many people going, like, I want to see how bad it is. And then after that, word spread like a cancer. And then all of a sudden, just everybody who was on that cast is just like, can we change our names in the credits, please?
I don't understand what's going on with Hollywood, with the remakes, the reboots, the retools, dragging the anime genre to the big screen. As we talked about last couple podcasts, bunch of anime and video game related movies coming out. Hollywood seems to have lost its originality. And, you know, I caught this on G4 a couple of days ago. Morgan brought up a good point. During this time of economic distress, as I like to call it, people embrace escapism. They want to play video games, and they want to go to the movies, and they want to forget about what's going on in real life. And to me, it's a slap in the face to go to a theater to escape from how crappy your life is and to sit through 90 minutes or 2 hours of a crappy film from a property that you know from your childhood or your early adulthood, and you want to use that as a method of escape. It's quite sad, actually.
Well, the common term is rape my childhood, which the first time I ever really heard that phrase used ad nauseum was in the case of Transformers, which, of course, then everybody recanted. But with the Ocular movie coming down the pipeline, which the premise for that, just westernizing the crap out of Ocular's, to me, is just like the worst idea ever. And, of course, the long in production hell Ava movie, they're going to look towards anime for better stories. And it's because anime just has better stories to be told. Now, does that necessarily mean that I want Keanu Reeves to be my Spike Spiegel? No. Not at all. I think that the idea of a Bebop movie, live action on the big screen, is great, because Bebop itself is film noir. It's emulating film noir, and it's emulating a really classy section of the film genre. But that doesn't mean that I need it, nor should I want to escape to something that's bad, or nor should I have to escape to something under the premise that it's good and then it's bad.
Well, you know what's ironic is, I actually argue in favor for a Bebop movie, and I know it's shocking coming from Negative Otherworld Steve, but what I find incredibly interesting about the property is that the studio, the anime studio, is behind it. You know, Watanabe is behind it. Watanabe is in charge of doing all the script reviews and potential rewrites and casting. So if the movie sucks, you actually have the creator to blame. So I'm all for it. If he feels Keanu is going to accurately represent his creation, I'm all for it. This kid Jake asks, what about an FMA movie? Yeah, they would ruin it. Well, I don't want to go off on too big of a tangent, but I have to say I'm really disappointed with Funimation's handling of the property, because it was a big powerhouse show in Japan, and when it came out over here, I was really excited about it, and I was snatching up the first DVDs as they were coming out. And then the only real merchandise I saw, aside from Japanese imports, was like wristbands and mints at Hot Topic. And I was like, what the hell is this? This is a great property. It's probably one of the more serious animes I've seen in a long time. For me, it's my favorite anime, hands down. And I was really disappointed that there wasn't that blitz involved, you know, that marketing and the associated merchandise. You know, Southern Island had a toy line coming out, and they just dragged their heels so long that by the time they're ready to launch, there wasn't a market for it anymore. And unfortunately, they filed for bankruptcy since. Fullmetal Alchemist is too niche. I don't think it really hit the mainstream like shows like Dragon Ball Z, Speed Racer, for better or worse, or even Cowboy Bebop. And even though Cowboy Bebop was fairly saturated on Cartoon Network, I think it could really do that property a great service to introduce it to a much more mass audience. And again, with having Watanabe on board and really overseeing the property, if it's done, I don't want to say religiously, like Alan Moore's Watchmen, but if it's done faithfully enough, I think people can really slide right into watching the anime and the anime movie and seeing what that was all about. And it could be a very fruitful property.
I think that the kiddies should, like anybody who's offended by offensive language should probably cover their ears right now, because this is where Mark gets, like, this is the sound of Mark getting pissed. When you say westernize an anime film, the Japanese are not held by the conservative stronghold. They're not worried as much about offending people over what they consider to be artistic content. Just search any number of artists and you'll see what I mean. And the fact is that, like, an FMA movie, for instance, and here's where the F-bomb drops, FMA is fucked up. Period. Okay? A kid missing two limbs and his brother's soul attached to a suit of armor. That is amazing. And that was amazing to me when I first saw it. I was like, this is riveting. I mean, this is the most messed up thing that I've ever seen, but this is absolutely riveting. And to try and westernize that, where it's like, well, what if kids start trying to cut off their limbs to be more like Edward Elric? They'll do it. They'll try and rationalize. They'll over-rationalize every single thing that is messed up about FMA. And even if they made it a trilogy of movies and they threw in the greed fight, which honestly, probably one of the best parts in the entire freaking series, and they'd cut its balls off. They'd just be like, oh, well, I can clap my hands and suddenly your entire carbon skin just goes back to normal skin. Like, no, that's not how it works, but okay. And FMA fans would get angry if there was an FMA live-action movie, because no studio would consent to the sheer amount of messed up crap that is in that movie. And honestly, Bebop is for adult audiences. It's not for teens, it's not for kids. And honestly, even if Watanabe's behind it, it's a hard sell. Because at this point, they're going to gel up the camera. It's going to have a very, very specific aesthetic look with lots of muted blues and possibly greens and things like that. And it's going to obviously have heavy drug use because of the red eye. It's going to have very, very bloody fights because of Vicious and Vicious versus Spike. Sexual content because of Faye. And then if they decide to do anything with Jet other than, you know, miscast him as some really angry black guy in the background. It's like, I'm knowledgeable and I'm supposed to be Morgan Freeman, but they couldn't afford Morgan Freeman, so I'm here. They'll wreck it. They'll wreck it so bad. And that's why the westernizing of anime in terms of live-action films scares the crap out of me.
Well, I have to interject about the term westernizing or westernization, because you're probably more familiar with the guy's name than I am, but the guy who created Metal Gear,
Kojima.
He said because of not just the state of the economy, but because of the worldwide distribution of video games and anime now, since it's become very niche in America, they need to have that world audience. If you're making a video game or an anime that's very Japanese specific regarding their culture, certain in jokes, TV series, whatever, it's not going to fare well overseas. So he is kind of leading the charge right now in Japan to say it has to reach that audience. It has to have a Western perspective to it, or a European perspective to it, in order for people to really embrace it. I think that's why anime such as Hellsing became so popular, because it wasn't a Japanese environment. It takes place in Europe, where a lot of the mass consuming market can acknowledge that. They can say, oh, okay, this is the world I live in. It's not this, you know, foreign culture with this foreign language. It's a lot of English speaking people. So I don't think westernization is typically a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing if you talk about a property like Akira, which was my gateway drug into anime. I think a lot of people in my generation, that was the first movie we ever saw, that Japanimation. It was Akira. It blew my freaking mind. Much like Full Metal Alchemist, it had that instant shock aspect where, like, holy crap, they can do this in a cartoon. But that's a film that's been so ingrained with me for the last 15, 20 years or whatever, that I couldn't imagine it taking place in Neo New York. It just shatters that entire illusion for me. A newer property probably wouldn't bother me as much, but not something I grew up with.
I think that with the right filmmaker and the right writer, you can make a movie play without having to westernize it, without having to make the characters seem familiar. Like, of course, you're going to have to flub a couple of things. Like, well, they're in Japan, but they all speak English. or even set it in Neo New York and still make the characters Asian. Like, do not call a kid Tetsuo and then hand me, you know, Justin Chatwin. But I think that you could make it play if you do it properly. I mean, obviously the fans are going to go for it if you say this is as faithful of an adaptation of the manga, not even the anime, but the manga that is Akira, to the point where they would go. And the visuals themselves will be sparkly enough that it could actually make the average person go. And if you promoted it properly, anyone would go. It's just a matter of getting the right kind of promotion behind it, giving it the right amount of money, and making sure that everyone knows, like, look, this is the demographic that we're going for. And if you have any kind of interest in anime, whether it be waning or not, you should see this film. Because this will be the first film that does it properly. Because personally, I like Speed Racer. I grew up on Speed Racer. I went to go see Speed Racer with my mom because that's how I was introduced to anime. She showed me Speed Racer. She hated that movie, but I just kind of loved the movie for the novelty of it. Like there's the Mach 5, and there's Spritel and Chim Chim and Pops and Trixie. But obviously, looking from outside of myself, I know why that movie's bad. And it just doesn't play in the way that it's supposed to. But you can make Bebop play. You can make Akira play. And you can most certainly make FMA play if they tried. And someone in the chat brought up Ghost in the Shell. Yeah, there's going to be a Ghost in the Shell live action movie. And that could play too. Again, yet another completely messed up movie where the protagonist is walking around naked when she needs to be invisible. Like, here's my boobies, you can't see me.
I think that's the aspect that scares me the most is that you're going to want to play to the mass audience. And the mass audience is that PG-13 audience. And so many of these properties we're discussing, in our mind anyway, would have to be R to really translate properly. And I'm wondering where that line really is. You know, are they going to say, let's be risky about this, a la... I was going to say a la Dark Knight, but that's not true. Because after watching The Dark Knight, I thought that should have been rated R, and it wasn't. So I wonder if they're going to push the envelope and go for that R rating with the potential for limited box office returns, or if they're going to go the safe and easy route, the PG or PG-13 movie, you kind of gloss over some of the things that make those properties so kick-ass.
Yeah, The Dark Knight nearly getting, like, pushing an R, like, that's entirely different just because of the fact that The Dark Knight has Warner Brothers behind it. So Warner Brothers can try and appeal anything that they want. I mean, obviously, they don't have to overtly appeal anything because, again, they're Warner Brothers. That's backroom deals. That's the fact that Chris Nolan knew the Batman movie that he wanted to make, and he knew what he wanted it to look like, and he knew that he wanted the real Joker, the Killing Joke, Long Halloween, Death in the Family Joker, not 90s animated series Mark Hamill Joker. So, of course, with the backing of Warner Brothers, you know, somebody in a black hoodie with sunglasses on went to the MPAA in the middle of the night and dropped off, you know, a yellow envelope filled with money. And miraculously, that film got a PG-13. But for Bebop, for Akira, for Ghost in the Shell, they'd never get past it. I mean, if they stay faithful to the source material, immediate R.
And if they stayed faithful to the source material, you might see the dreaded NC-17.
Yeah, seriously. Because, especially in Ghost in the Shell's case, because it's like, well, in the TV show, she can, like, Motoko can be invisible whenever, but if we're going off the movies, well, Motoko needs to strip naked and jump off a building, and then she's totally invisible, you can't see her, period. So, if they stay faithful to the source material, they'll get an R or an NC-17 in Ghost in the Shell's case, and if they try and play it safe and play to teens... Because the most that any of those movies could ever get, or the least that they could ever get slapped with, is a PG-13. Because if they try and make... Like, would you seriously go to see Akira if it was, you know, The Grand Vision, Akira, rated PG, general audiences? I mean, would you go to see that, really? Or would you throw something at your screen?
I was reading a comment in the chat here saying, here are three reasons they shouldn't turn anime into live-action movies. It's a style of animation that doesn't translate to live action. There are often cultural issues that don't translate, and most anime and manga are not like American comics in that there is usually one canon by one person or team, and if there are more, they all work together on it. While I agree with those points, I don't think it necessarily stops a good anime property being brought to the big screen. I think Hollywood has to stop looking at the immediate, well, you know, if we put $150 million in, how much are we going to get back? and really look at it more passionately and say, what is this property about? What does it have to offer? What are people going to take away from this film? I think, again, Hollywood is just way off track right now, and I really don't know what it's going to take to bring it back.
Well, Hollywood's kind of all over the place, but obviously every studio is buying up every comic book property, American comic book property, that they can, to the point where they're going to make an attempt at Witchblade, which Witchblade is Witchblade. Witchblade is awesome. If they do Witchblade right, that means there will be the Darkness, more money. If they do the Darkness right, that means there will be an Angelus. And then they'll have this gigantic anime-like canon, which they can just run into the ground in terms of merchandising, t-shirts, you know, perfume at Hot Topic. Like, here, have the Stabbing Death, the preferred perfume of Sarah Pazzini from Witchblade, you know. And obviously the same thing could be done to anime, not for anime, not by anime. But at the same time, I mean, we as anime fans, all of us, like the people in this room, the people beyond this room who go to cons, we're all apprehensive about live-action translations of anime properties, especially good ones. But there are just certain things where, like, I recognize the fact that there's just no way that you can screw it up. If they announced Trigun, the live-action film, tomorrow, I would not have a thing to say but awesome. Because it's, I mean, yeah, it gets deep in the later DVDs and the later episodes, but for the most part, it's a goofy guy who has an awesome gun and just shoots at stuff all day. That, like, those are the things that they should be trying to translate, like, just to kind of lay the groundwork, you know, lay the foundation. Like, well, let's just get a bunch of properties that everybody really, really loves, but we just can't possibly fathom screwing it up because they're so simple. Give me Gungrave. Give me Trigun. Give me, crap, give me Tenchi. And then, like, if you gave me Tenchi, then, like, yeah, one of the original and best harem animes ever. And that would play as a chick flick. It would play as an action chick flick, so then girlfriends could get their guys to go and not be pissed.
No, and instead we're going to get Voltron and Thundercats and, you know, more raping of my childhood and on and on and on.
Yeah, but, you know, when I walk by a theater just seeing another movie and I hear coming from a theater wherever as I'm going to the bathroom, Sword of Omens, give me sight beyond sight, I am going to just bust out laughing. That'll be comedy gold to me.
Well, that's my concern. They're going to take that route of, like, you know, Dukes of Hazzard and Miami Vice and just really parried it right up, because to do it faithfully and to make it look nice is going to cost, you know, $200 million. And if the interest isn't really there initially, you might just see a spoof, and that's pretty sad.
Well, Thundercats, they can play to kids, because Thundercats, even as the original copy, wasn't really that messed up or really all that complicated. Like, the movies that they can play to kids are the shows like Thundercats, Voltron, the Ronin Warriors, and those are the movies that they should be working on, focusing on, trying to refine the technique of, so that way every movie back to back will be a learning experience. And then if someone came to me after they did Ronin Warriors and the Thundercats and everything else, and they said, all right, and now we're going to go to the next level, which is trying to make a more deeply seated anime movie. We're going to try and make Trigun. We're going to try and make Ghost in the Shell. We're going to try and make this property, that property. Then I'd be, well, you know what? You've had enough time to figure it out, so go right ahead. Like, if the Wachowski brothers came down and said, like, we're going to do Dragon Ball Z the way it was meant to be done. Well, considering the fact that the last fight in the Matrix Revolutions was Goku versus Vegeta, I'm happy with that.
I'd be happy with that, but of course that's not the case.
No, it just fell into the wrong hands and we all died a little inside. Thank you, Justin Chatwin. You suck.
On that note, let's move on to something else here, shall we?
Absolutely.
QTV launches console IPTV platform for the PlayStation 2? What? In one of the more unexpected developments from NAB 2009, QTV is pushing its streaming media player platform for a console. Not an altogether radical idea, we know, but what's different here is a plan to launch first on the PlayStation 2 and move to newer hardware later. From the makers of the QCast technology behind the GameShark media player, QTV includes YouTube and access to streaming videos from other sources, plus pictures, music, and video from USB devices on network computers. The PS2 may not be the first HD set-top box we thought of, but it does have the highest install base. the QTV player launches later this year and will be available on Mac and PC as well for, quote, less than $50. Although thanks to the 3 30-day trial, the hardest part may be remembering where we left our PS2s. Really out of left field here, and actually a move I applaud, because rather than going for the latest and greatest, they're going for the largest install base, and I certainly can't blame them there.
Well, I don't blame them at all. I mean, the PS2 as a system sold amazingly through all its iterations. And honestly, I was reading an article maybe a couple days ago that was yet another one of those articles. The PS2, a dead system? Uh-uh. And that's partially because of the fact that obviously the emotion engine chip now is a term that's like emotion and the what the blah? Yeah. So going for the install base is absolutely nice. I mean, I was actually looking at a PS2 in Best Buy today, just going like, wow, it's $99. I could totally rock that. But the reason why I was late was because I didn't have enough money in my account. So didn't do that.
I was talking earlier with the guys at Primitive of the Void about the PS3, and my brother-in-law actually said, you know, what's the deal with the PS3? He just bought one recently. He's a very late adopter. And he says, I can't play my PS2 games in it. You have to only buy the first-gen consoles, which is still going for a lot of money on eBay and whatnot. And, of course, my conspiracy theorist, other than Steve, said there's got to be something to that. There's so much access to PlayStation 2 games nowadays on the cheap. If you could go out either on eBay or a brick-and-mortar store and pick up, you know, 10 PS2 games for the price of what it would cost for one PS3 game, Sony wouldn't be making any sales in the PS3 department, because a lot of games are cross-platform, and if you have a 360, chances are you're going to pick it up for that anyway. So, I don't know. I think there's a conspiratorial angle there.
Well, Sony needs to continue to generate PS2 sales, obviously, because they're still producing them. Because it was proven in the span of Final Fantasy VII, where it's like, well, Final Fantasy VII was the last PlayStation game that was in heavy production. And that came out in 1996, 97. And that didn't stop printing until 2002. So they know where their hardest of the hardcore fans, where the I bleed gradient blue blood fans are. And they know that those fans are dead broke from a library of more than 5,000 games, plus imports. So, of course, they're going to continue to support it. And if someone comes up with a good idea that's going to sell a couple more systems, absolutely. Because what was last week's number? The PS2 sold 116,000 units over the course of the last month.
Wow, that's amazing. It really is. Although I have heard some market analysts speculate that the $99 price tag is kind of the death knell for the PS2, that this is going to be the last iteration of the PS2. It's been around for like 32 years, so gee, you know, it's kind of about time.
Yeah, but I really wouldn't want to see the system die. I'm looking across the room at my Dreamcast right now, which I still get a lot of good play out of. Directly next to that is the Sega Saturn, and right above that Saturn is my Xbox 360. I still get good play out of old systems, and if they continue to support them, absolutely. I mean, there are a ton of third-party companies that are making Sega Genesis and NES and Super NES systems, and they're actually combining them all into a single box. And the market is there. I mean, retro gaming does not only refer to the NES and the Atari anymore. I mean, every console that we leave behind becomes a retro game, and it doesn't take that long for it to garner that title. I mean, the Dreamcast came out in 1999. It came out a decade ago. It's officially retro. And that makes the NES and the Genesis vintage. That makes the Super NES vintage. That makes the Sega Saturn vintage. And if anybody remembers them, the Jaguar and the 3DO, which are essentially paperweights on some fat guy's desk somewhere who lives in his mom's basement. But yeah, the fact is that the PlayStation 2 has a library of over 5,000 titles, and I haven't even begun to see what really, really came out for the PlayStation. Obviously, I would never endeavor to own every one of those games, because I really don't need a coaster that says Big Mother Truckers on it, because that's all I'd use it for. But just imagine if there were a website that had the entire library on it, Steve, where you could just sit there and all of a sudden your PS2 has new life because suddenly it's, wow, it's domestic and it's imports. They released Nights in the Dreams on the PS2 in Japan. It never came here, but it was released in Japan, and it was amazing because of the fact that you're revisiting Nights in the Dreams, the Sega Saturn game, the best Sega Saturn game ever made, and it has updated graphics, the music sounds better, the control scheme's a little bit better, and it comes to Christmas Nights, a limited edition expansion to the game. So your PS2 will have life for long after you die, based purely on the fact that it was easy to develop for, and there are a ton of games for it. So they can say that the price drop is a death rattle, but that won't mean a single thing. If I had a child, I would hand him a PS2 and say, here, forget the nanotech system that beams it into your brain. Here's a TV, here's a controller, play it.
Well, you know, when Sony stopped the support for the PS2 games, they said that their intent was to redevelop, redigitize, or whatever, to bring them to their online marketplace. And it's been a few years, and that hasn't come to fruition. And it's really unfortunate because, again, there's such this massive, iconic library that's out there. And some people say in the chats, yeah, you know, there are some PlayStation 2 emulators out there, but they're still really buggy and really laggy. You're not going to find anything that's going to really give you that playability and experience like playing an original PS2. I still have mine, and it's kind of funny because time to time some Dragon Ball Z games still come out for the PS2 and I pick them up. So when I look over into my home theater, I see my PS3, my 360, and my PS2. So I guess you know where my heart is.
Yeah. And the whole trying to convert the more popular parts of the library to bring it to the PSN, I mean, that's a really cute idea. I mean, obviously, they're going to go with the things that sold the most. They're going to go with the things that resonated with the fan base the most. So they're going to go with Kingdom Hearts. They're going to go with Final Fantasy X and X-2 for some strange reason. And eventually, Final Fantasy XII. And 2 weeks ago in Japan, the PSN got Final Fantasy VII, an emulated version of Final Fantasy VII, not the true copy of Final Fantasy VII. That would be the hard-coded copy where it's like, okay, all we had to do was switch code around and now it's available. They had to pull it from an actual disc that's an emulated disc. But they did it. They got Final Fantasy VII. The Japanese got Final Fantasy VII. And I'm sure that on the PSN, the Japanese PSN probably broke that day. Despite the fact that hardcore gamers all own their non-greatest hits copy of Final Fantasy VII, to have a digital copy of what they consider to be the greatest Final Fantasy of all time is priceless. In the same way that when Castlevania Symphony of the Night came out for Xbox Live Arcade, I flipped out because even though I own a copy, that's a copy that'll never go bad. That's a copy I don't have to worry about cleaning, maintaining, you know, putting in a lockbox 5 miles underground with no air. So them digitizing parts of the library, I mean, it's a really good idea, but at the same time, you know, there's still that collector's aspect. Sony has generated a fan base which enjoys to collect their product, and yet they're not really supporting them in a way that they could be or should be, because they're too focused on trying to bail out the sinking ship that is the PS3 in a number of senses. So, and I really think that they should support the PS2 a little bit more. You know, keep the games available for a little bit longer. Keep the systems available for a little bit longer. I mean, if you can make the PS2 any smaller to the point where it fits in your pocket like the last generation PlayStation did, I'd say go for it. Because
that's an interesting concept, because a lot of the games could probably be compressed down to UMD and available on the PSP. And I'm just really wondering why nobody's gone ahead and jumped on that just yet. If you made even a portion of the PS2 library available on UMD for the PSP, I would probably pick my PSP back up.
Yeah, that in itself is a brilliant idea. I mean, even if they made it digital download and coming all the way back around the digital distro, if they just said, well, screw the UMD, UMD's a dead format, we'll make it so that when the PSP2 comes out, which will still boast PS2.5 graphics. If they made those digital distro and made the retail copy like, okay, well, this is like, here you go, here's a code that you can download, and then it's on your PSP, on your flash memory, I would go for that. I would totally go for that. And on top of that, it's all the games that I loved coming out of the PS2 on the go forever, on a piece of digital media. Like, I would love to have the original Jak and Daxter. I would love to have Jak 2 and Jak 3 on my PSP. In the same way, I would love to have all of Ratchet and Clank as a series on my PSP. And that would actually encourage Flash Media sales, where it's like, well, this one's the entire Jak trilogy. This one's the entire Ratchet trilogy. And here's all my Final Fantasies, and here's this, and here's that. And that would be a way to really keep the PS2 flame burning. But again, Sony doesn't really seem to be interested in what essentially what could be called coddling their own fandom. But at the same time, they're so used to primping their fandom. Like, well, then, so what, you want to have sex with them and not cuddle after?
Yeah, Sony's the only one of the big three that seems to be, like, so against their fan base. Microsoft and Nintendo give in to a certain extent. Sony just seems to be like, you know, I'm going to take a dump on you, and you just have to deal with it. Oh, by the way, that's $50.
Yeah, it's an abusive relationship that we all have with Sony, where, you know, Sony smacks us around the house, and we go to the doctor, and Sony's standing right there. Doctor goes, well, what happened to you? What happened to you, Mark? I fell down some stairs.
Let's move on to something that I feel is possibly equally ridiculous, if not more. And Spike TV is going to bring us some new reality TV coming to the boob tube near you. Apparently, Spike TV is jumping into the pirates chasing business with its all-new reality series covering the U.S. Navy's ongoing operation to end the threat of hijacking off the African coast. The U.S. Navy is allowing Spike and production company 44 Blue in-depth access as they embark on their mission from a military base in the seaside nation of, I can't even pronounce that, but it borders Somalia and Ethiopia, and on the open water. Cameras will capture life aboard two USS warships, the USS San Antonio and the USS Boxer, as they patrol the Gulf of Aden for pirates who hijack commercial transport vessels. The show, titled Pirate Hunters, USN, is produced by 44 Blue Productions and Adam Friedman. Piracy off the coast of Africa is a real and deadly threat, says somebody whose name I also can't pronounce, but that is the president and founder of 44 Blue. With Pirate Hunter USN, our goal is to capture that drama for the TV audience in order to highlight the heroic work undertaken by the U.S. Navy every day for its fight against terrorism. The announcement comes right after the dramatic five-day standoff where Navy SEAL snipers rescued an American cargo ship captain and killed three Somali pirates in a rescue operation. Gee, I wonder if that's going to be on the highlights reel for this show.
First, I thought this was going to be produced by Kojima Productions and directed by freaking David Hayter. The idea of a reality show where, I mean, obviously it's not going to be broadcasted live because that would be too sensationalist, and we're not in the 90s anymore, so sensationalist television is gone the way of the dinosaur for anyone in this room that can actually remember hard copy. Do you remember hard copy, Steve?
You know, sadly enough, I do.
Oh, yeah. 90s sensationalist television. It all started when animals attack, and then it just caught fire. But still, it's just a strange thing because to actually have an actual show where they will be televising Navy SEAL tactics and Navy SEAL formations, it's asinine. Because didn't Geraldo Rivera get in trouble for broadcasting live exactly where the troops he was interviewing was and where they were going to be looking? It's the exact same thing where it's just like, all right, well, they're going to use the, like, and this is the part where they use the B formation. It's when the team leader gets in the front and then they get in a V position behind him. Then the point man goes around the corner. And it's going to get them in trouble. And it truly shows the saturation of reality television to the point where it's like, okay, not even Navy SEALs are safe from the all-seeing eye of reality television. I don't even want to see a bunch of bratty kids in a house. Why would I want to see a bunch of Navy SEALs? Like, I am sleeping at night very well knowing that, like, whatever their tactics are, they're working. If they're drowning people and calling it waterboarding, I know that it's working. And the fact is that I will maintain an ostrich syndrome in terms of waterboarding. Like, look, I don't see him drown the guys, so it didn't happen. It's not drowning him.
You know, in a way, I can understand what they're saying. They want to highlight this issue. It's a big issue, and it's been growing. But the bigger part of it, I think, is the sensationalism, of course. You know, it's that's what's going to get people to tune in. You know, how many pirates are the U.S. Navy going to shoot this week, and how many ships are they going to sink, and blah, blah, blah. Sensationalizing the issue, I don't think, is necessarily going to help us deal with the issue. And frankly, you know, on a personal political note, it's about time that the U.S. Navy get involved. I think they should have a long time ago, as soon as it became an issue. But it's almost like capitalizing on a really, really, really sad issue. I don't know how many South Park fans we have in our listener base, but I watched an episode last night about on South Park dealing with the Somali pirates issue, and it's pretty disturbing. It's not funny. Even a show like South Park can't portray it as being funny. And it's not like Cops. It's nothing like that. You're talking about people who hijack boats and hold people for ransom and kill people if they deem it's necessary. So to sensationalize it on a quote-unquote reality TV show, maybe I'm getting old, maybe I'm getting soft. I just find that aspect pretty disturbing.
But I think that this is actually what separates, like, this conversation right here is the absolute proof that violent video games do not make for violent, apathetic people. Because if we were playing Gears of War, if we were playing Halo, if we were playing Call of Duty 4, we'll shoot terrorist assholes all day. Just like, I got you in the head. Yeah, that's your nuts halfway across the room now because I sniped him. But when we're faced with it, when it's real, when it's actual terrorists and it's actual people being held hostage and being killed and actual Navy SEALs who have to risk their lives and assert themselves on a boat and pretty much have to execute these people if they don't immediately comply, which obviously they're going to defend themselves and obviously they're going to get a bullet right between their eyes. We don't think this is funny. We don't think that this is entertaining. This is not a game. This is not me sitting in the comfort of my own home holding a controller, controlling the action. This is freaking real, and it is not to be sensationalized. It is not to be trivialized, and it is most certainly not to be televised. There is a reason why it is that there is the term black ops. These people are not supposed to be out in the forefront, but they did one heroic thing and all of a sudden, like, well, that just ratcheted patriotism up. So if patriotism goes up, that means that conservative attitudes goes down because of the fact that patriotism is more important than a conservative attitude.
Yeah, Gemno in the chat says, that'd be like making a TV show about people who fly planes into buildings after 9/11. And as morbid as it sounds, I kind of have to echo that sentiment. It is a really morbid thing. You know, George Carlin, God rest his soul, for a comedian, he was pretty politically adept. And George Carlin did this big skit on political correctness about how, you know, growing up in the 70s and the soldiers were coming back from Vietnam, they had shell shock.
Shell shock.
People understood that. You know what that meant. It was very self-descriptive. Nowadays, it's post-traumatic stress disorder, and everything's becoming very sanitized. And that's my fear with a reality show like this. You're not going to see the real story. Even on a quote-unquote reality TV show, you're not going to see it. You're not going to see people getting hurt, maimed, killed, which part of me really appreciates because after a long, hard day at work, I don't want to come home and see that. But you're not going to see the whole side. So not only does it sensationalize it, but it sanitizes it and it misses the mark. I don't think it has that impact, especially to American viewers. We're already very cynical as it is. I don't think that people are going to sit back on it and weigh heavy on it and it's really going to change them spiritually and emotionally. It's another TV show. If you're not watching that, you're going to be watching Tila Tequila or something else. And yeah, the entire sentiment is, it's a shame. It just goes to show you, you know, I was bitching about Hollywood earlier, but it just goes to show you where the entertainment industry as a whole is right now.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely in the toilet to the point where they're going to turn what is genuine military ops, what the entire military channel is based on, and they really don't pull any punches, but at the same time, they don't quite show you everything that you would see otherwise and actually in the field either. But they're going to turn it into a giant Navy recruitment video. Like, do you want to shoot pirates? Then you need to join the Navy. Just like that Simpsons episode where, you know, the guy was like, well, we have three forms of recruitment advertising. Subliminal, liminal, and superliminal. And Lisa's like, superliminal? And then he just gets out the window and there's a kid walking across the street and he goes, hey you, join the Navy. All right, I think I will. And that's what this is going to turn into, especially since it's on Spike TV, yet another entertainment medium that is a notch below Highlights for Children intellectually, where they need big names, big stars, big voices to do the voiceover for every possible show that they can come up with to draw your attention and make you watch and saturate your brain with this asinine crap.
Asinine crap, indeed. Indoctrination.
And the fact is that they're not gonna make any kind of secret about it either, because I will bet you $50 that when that show airs, that every Join the Navy commercial with Keith David's voice in it will play. And you'll hear his wonderful, wonderful baritone voice, and it's like, oh yay, it's Spawn! And it's like, I think I want to join the Navy because Spawn told me to join the Navy. And it's just gonna be, it's really gonna be a temple rubbing endeavor. Like, it's really gonna be something that's gonna make me sit back in my chair and go, I'm only watching this because I need to see a train wreck right now. Like, obviously, after the train wreck starts, it's like, it's horrible, I can't look away. But I need to see how bad it's going to be.
I don't. I don't. I really don't. I guess it's different being old and crotchety. I don't know. I don't see the entertainment appeal to it. Pretty soon there's going to be a PlayStation 3 and a 360 game. Rescue the American captain from the Somali pirates, part 10.
Well, what's that game that's coming out, Fallujah, where there's going to be an entire game based on the invasion and occupancy of Fallujah, which all the source material for the game is coming from the Marines and the Army men who were all in that occupation, and they're pretty much trying. They're not trying to sell it at all as like, no, this game is entertaining. This game is going to be the best game that you've played since freaking Modern Warfare. They're not selling it as that at all. They're selling it as this is a very real account as to the horror that we experienced in Fallujah, and you will have a first person account as to everything that happened. To which brings up
Now,
this whole games versus art debate.
right. Now, in a video game, of course, video games have been pushing the envelope for the last decade or so with the over the top sex and violence. I'm certainly not condemning them for that. I think the games have been properly rated, regardless of whether or not the stores decide to follow those ratings when they sell them. But that's neither here nor there. So, in a game, you can actually have that very graphical representation of what it's like. Sorta, kinda, to actually be in a combat situation. Do you think the average person picking up a game like that and playing through some real combat scenarios and seeing some emulated, albeit carnage, on the television screen, do you think they're going to be able to empathize with that, or do you think it's pure entertainment value at that point?
Well, in the case of Fallujah, I really don't think that. I mean, despite the man's best efforts, it's not going to play as anything other as entertainment. Obviously, it's not going to have gigantic Hollywood-style set pieces. It's not going to have sparkly graphics like or sparkly special effects. It's going to be real. It's going to be dirt and blood and shrapnel. And no matter how real they make it, no matter how hardcore they make it. It's still going to play as entertainment value because at the end of the day, I mean, once again, you're the hero. I mean, yeah, they've said for the development of this Fallujah game that it's going to be a very squad-based game, but so are a bunch of Tom Clancy games, and you're still the hero in that. And same thing for Call of Duty. You're still the hero in that, despite the fact that you're dependent on your squad, and if one of your squad mates dies, you have to go back to your last checkpoint. But it is you holding a controller, and if you decide, well, you know what? I don't want to follow formation. I'm just gonna run over the freaking pillar, and then it's gonna be Rambo time. Then that's what you're gonna do. So, unfortunately, I think it's going to miss the initial point of the fact that it's not really supposed to be entertaining. It's just supposed to be accurate.
I had a disturbing thought while you were talking, and that was, can you imagine if they made that game, and then if you got injured during the course of your battle, you had to go to like Walter Reed Hospital, and the game goes to a cut scene and pans around different wounded soldiers at Walter Reed. That would have a very profound impact. Of course, somebody would bitch about that and say, oh, you can't release a game like that, blah, blah, blah.
That's insensitive. Wah.
Yeah. If anything, it emphasizes the sensitivity that you have to have for people who are going through these things. Jimno again in the chat says, real life doesn't have a checkpoint. And I think that really exemplifies the point exactly. It's so detached from reality that unless you're involved with it firsthand, you're not going to understand it. And it's really sad because I perceive it as taking these very real life and tragic events and just turning around and capitalizing on them for entertainment value. And if that's what our society has come to, I really fear for how this generation is going to grow up. That it's really sad.
I think that a commitment that should be made in Fallujah, harking on Jimno's point about real life doesn't have a checkpoint, I think that they should do it like Capcom did Steel Battalion. Where in Steel Battalion, if your mech took too much damage and you didn't hit the eject button on the controller, that was it. Game over. Start over. Same thing in Fallujah. It should be that if you take a bullet, like, no checkpoints. Forget it. You have to play this game, not necessarily to the end, but break it up into chapters. So that way, you know, people aren't trying to play this game for 10 hours straight. Like, no checkpoints in the middle of a chapter. Long, endurance-style chapters. And if you take a bullet, then you need a field medic. And if you don't get to a field medic, and if you don't have a field medic kit, If you take a bullet, then obviously you should start taking performance damage, where it's like, well, I can't shoot my gun as straight anymore. I'm coughing up blood. You know, just keep it as real as possible, just because they can do it. They can make it so that, like, if I take a bullet in the gut, suddenly I'm not breathing as well anymore. But if they made it as real as that, then that rips out some of the entertainment value. That rips out that complete disregard for the protagonist's life, where it's just like, whatever, I've got a checkpoint. So if you take out checkpoints, it works.
Well, I guess my question at that point is, if a developer was to take that route, do you think at that point it's even marketable?
I think to the patriots in this country, that's absolutely marketable. Because, I mean, the game has no political agenda as far as what's been seen and as far as what's been written and showed to the public. The game has absolutely no political agenda. It's not trying to portray America in a positive light, trying to, you know, really, really get the red, white, and blue up the arsehole. It's just saying this is a real account as to what happened from a first person perspective from the people who lived it, from the stories written by the people who lived it. And the patriots in this country, even though it's not pro-America, would still eat that up because of the fact that they feel for the troops. And there are more patriots in this country than skeptics, by a very small margin. And even I, as not necessarily a patriot, I mean, I love my country because of the fact that I'm allowed to be a black goth kid that lives in Pennsylvania and doesn't have to clean toilets for a living if I don't want to. But yeah, I feel that it could still be marketable, not only to patriots, but to people who really are interested in real historical accounts. Because if there are 100 million World War II games that sell amazingly, I mean, I'm sure that this could do just as well, even though it's recent.
That's true. We are really riding those WW2 game waves, and that seems like a market that's not going to end anytime soon. And, geez, looking at the clock here, this is a podcast. It doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. You got anything else in your bag of holding over there, Mark?
Yes. Something a whole lot less depressing and good news for everybody. There's going to be a $10 game sale at Best Buy starting on Sunday. That's right. Starting this Sunday, which is the 26th, through May 2nd, retail giant Best Buy will be having yet another massive video game clearance, setting a multitude of titles for the pleasing sum of $9.99 each, to which there are a ton of games in this list, and most of them are shovelware, but here's just some of the really, really awesome ones that are available. The PS3, some of the $10 titles are The Bourne Conspiracy. I played it and loved it. If anyone's a Zero Punctuation fan, Clive Barker presents Clive Barker's Jericho by Clive Barker. Guitar Hero 3, I know you're not going to play that, Steve. Fracture, which got mediocre around the board. Hail to the Chimp, which I'm told is ridiculously fun. Overlord, which is ridiculously fun. Lost Planet, for those who haven't played it. play it. It's awesome, despite a really bad control scheme. Soul Calibur 4. For the Xbox 360, 007 Quantum of Solace, not that bad. Again, the porn conspiracy. The Bourne Conspiracy, Devil May Cry 4, Enemy Territory, Quake Wars, Hellboy, Silent Hill Homecoming for survival horror-ish fans, Unreal Tournament 3, and one more good pick. Come on, one more good pick. Command and Conquer.
I think you said it all with Porn Conspiracy.
Yeah, I know. I like porn. Like, I want to buy the Porn Conspiracy for $10. That's awesome.
That's great. And then the BBB will evolve it. Hey, let's talk boobies.
And in the spirit of Kyle, my homie who ain't here, boobies. Anyway, the PS2 still holding strong, which really, honestly, all the titles are crap. High School Musical 3, Monster Lab, Dancing with the Stars. Like, yeah, what was that about the PS2's death rattle? DS, so, more crap.
Oh, DS2? It's not just PS2?
Yeah, DS, Cheetah Girls, Disney, Corey in the House, the Walt Naked Disney. Brothers Band, Prince of Persia, The Tale of Despero, Rock Revolution, Tecmo Bowl, and WWE 2009 SmackDown. And the Wii list currently is Battle of the Bands, Naked Brothers Band, Pets Crazy Monkeys, Popstar Guitar, Rubik's World, Samba de Amigo, Tale of Despero, and Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. Now, this list is not absolutely definite. It's subject to change by Sunday, but there is some good stuff to snag for $10 at Best Buy, and I most certainly will be there with bells on to at least pick up Devil May Cry 4, because I loved that game until the middle.
And that's when Kyle's character popped up, right?
Yeah, when I was in the middle of playing the game and Kyle's like, oh yeah, I'm the big frog thing with the half-naked spirit ladies. I was just like, really? Hold on, let me play it again. Oh yeah, that is you. What is it with you and spirits that are half-naked? And that is our extremely good news for the week. $10 games, which is super-duper awesome.
Pretty cool deal over at Best Buy. I might head over this weekend and might be interested to follow up on a future podcast to share our purchases. I guess, you know, like anybody else, we need to make room for new inventory, so it's all good. So yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm really glad Ustream has been working for us flawlessly. I'd like to take this opportunity to very graciously thank the very famous Mark Swint for guest hosting last couple of weeks while Kyle's been away. Round of applause. Thanks, Mark. Look forward to using you again when Kyle's away at his next con. Yeah. Mark said he continued to be working behind the scenes for the Big Ball broadcast. So, yay, Mark. And with that concludes another epic episode of the BBB. And that's all I got. I'll let you play us out, Mark.
Right on. I'm Mark Swint.
And this is Otherworld Steve.
See ya!
Check out www.thebigballbroadcast.com, the central hub for all the geeky news that you can use. There you'll find links to our Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, and blog pages. Catch up on all our past episodes at blog.thebigballbroadcast.com. Send your MP3 comments and emails to mel@thebigballbroadcast.com. You can also subscribe for free via iTunes to have new episodes downloaded automatically. Donations graciously accepted and appreciated. Transmission complete.